Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have Peggy DeRee talking about her anthology, Slow Lightning, and we have my co-host Richard Modiano, who will handle the intellectual part of this interview.
Okay, we're talking to Peggy DeRee, the editor of Slow Lightning in Practical Poetry. And for our listeners, Peggy herself is a very accomplished poet. She has 3 books to her credit. We'll talk about that a little later toward the end, but this is the book that we're going to be talking about today, and this anthology was recently released. And tell us how it came about, Peggy.
Well, it actually was born out of morning sessions that I started doing just after the insurrection. My friend Janet Fitch called me up, and she suggested that I do this somatic meditation practice and free write that I do in my classes. And she said, let's just do it every morning because everybody's kind of falling apart and struggling to focus. And first couple of times she asked, I said no. And then I kind of got a little crazy myself and needed the help settling into my own meditation. So I started doing it January 12th. And I started to fall in love with these poems, and many of the people were not poets. They were novelists or memoirists who came through Janet's classes at Community of Writers, or they were poets who came through my embodied poetry workshops. A few were artists that just kind of heard about it and came. And so I started collecting these poems and was really just going to put together a little chapbook, you know, hand-stapled, you know, at my desk as a Christmas gift. And then David Orr, who is a wonderful artist, designer, book designer from Philosophical Research Society, said, well, let me look at it. Let's make a cover. And he made this beautiful book. So it's somewhere in between an official editorial project and a kind of accidental, you know, gift to ourselves.
Well, it came out. It was if that was its fortuitous origins. Indeed, it was fortuitous because it is really a fine anthology. One of the things, another question that I want to follow up on that is, it is broken down into chapters, 3 chapters.
Right.
And when you were exchanging poems with each other, did these start as prompts, or did you just exchange poems and then you got the whole group and then you decide, hey, this fits here, that fits there?
All of these poems came from prompts that we did together. Now, to be fair, there's like 27 people that are signed up, and on any one day 5 to 12 might be there, so it's always a different mix. And in addition, this first year also included some people who came to me as private clients or people who were in my embodied poetry workshops, you know, which I started again by default because the pandemic ate up all my work and I had to take some money, pay some rent. And so I started teaching. I had been doing some teaching with Brendan Constantine and kind of a blend of my somatic meditation stuff and his wonderful, you know, way of weaving a sort of intellectual process with prompts. And I sort of, you know, built off of that and started making up my own classes. So there were students from that, and there were also students from a series that I loved doing on the equinox or the solstice called Slumber Write, where we would write all night long, meet from twilight to dawn every 3 hours and write. and sort of tie into the sum of the mythology of the moon or, you know, whatever I dreamt up, right? And so there's all of those people included in this first book. We're working on a second anthology now. And thank you, by the way, for your kind words about it. I, too, just feel like these are remarkable poems, you know, from people who said, oh, I'm not a poet, you know, and they would read these poems and, you know, my jaw would drop. And this is at 8:30 in the morning.
Well, to give our listeners an idea of what we're talking about, chapter one is called Ifs, Ands, Maybe, Buts, and Heavy Metal, / Heavy Metal. One of the poems that I liked in that, I mean, they were all of a level of excellence, let me put it that way. One that really caught me was Identity by Jacinta Camacho Kaplan, and I wonder if you could read that one for us.
I would love to. We all sort of have our sort of personalities now within the group. And for Jacinta, she has this wonderful way of tying the immediate with a really varied history that she has. Identity. My twin died at birth for no apparent reason. The midwife confirms this. Mama says we are identical. I remember my sister when I pull white lacy socks over my 3-year-old feet and my toddler daughter's feet. When I try to hook my first training bra, assume my breasts mirror her breasts, or have her wait for my water to break after the 37th week as if I was incapable of acting alone. As if I was car without petrol, a sentence without sound, my identical twin pushing and pulling a child from me, together, always together, even when the first gray hairs were plucked from my side part, one silver strand next to the other, as if she might lengthen this decade. Or the days when my double vision came from two separate yet merging women, twin vision, aligned but not. We were seal pups, exactly similar with a trace of separation. If the stronger fetus suspected an imbalance, was she willing to share placental resources with her weaker twin? Or was the failing child begging for food and breath denied both? Were values forming in the womb we shared? I remember everything but that. I remember waiting for her. Surprised I was alone.
Well, it's very powerful, very powerful. And... one of the things I want to emphasize, there is a range of voices in each of these sections. And Peggy, why don't you pick another one from chapter one so that we can show people just the extraordinary type of voices that contributed to this anthology.
That would be interesting. Let's see. I opened my own. Let's not do that. Let's read. Oh, I love this. This is from a writer from Embodied Poetry. I think she also did one slumber write. Muriel Carr, A Few Things About My Father. For my 50th birthday, I wanted to waltz with my father, but despite party balloons and my festive ficus, he refused to dance. I fixed him a salad of unripe strawberries, slicing off the green parts, but he said the red was a waste of his time to eat. At 12, I had been so proud of rearranging my closet with its narrow bookshelf, but when he inspected, he called it deplorable, which I had to look up in my Green Funk and Wagnalls. So in part, I thank him for my passion for words. Maybe he loved me deeply, the way he loved his dog, that shining red Irish setter whose name was Beggar. Beware of strange men lurking behind trees, he warned when I left for college. Run to the roadhouse, Nellie. He'll never corner you there, was a joke he enjoyed repeating. I know he broke down at my mother's grave. Then after she died, he climbed on a sort of raft and started to sail far away. Till he wrote a letter to his first wife, his high school sweetheart, whom he never mentioned, and married her again 60 years later to the day. It was she who told me that on the ER gurney when he was dying, he wept and said, I'm sorry. Neither of us knows quite why.
Yeah, that's another very strong piece. And I think that characterizes virtually all of the poems of this anthology. Moving on to chapter two, political promiscuity, stature and statutes. And since it was the events of the insurrection, the start of the insurrection really begins with the election of Donald Trump, let's be honest. Because that,
right.
That's where it started. That's where it started. So I wonder if you would read for us November 2016 by Janet Fitch.
Oh, one of my favorites. And again, Janet was the muse for starting this whole thing, so shout out, Janet. November 2016. Some people thought it was inevitable. It took others by surprise. Most of us in our little corner of reality had no idea this could happen. We bought champagne, pictures of grandmothers to share in the triumph. But two brought whiskey and they cracked it by seven. They'd come from Alabama. We didn't open the champagne for 4 years. It sat in refrigerators, under the stairs, in the garage, the back of the closet. No celebration in those years. The ones who saw it coming did better than the rest. Their midnight humor guided us. Don't be surprised, they said. It's been here all along. By the end, if you can call it an end, we learned to be more like them. We didn't pop those bottles till we were sure.
That's nice. That's, of course, it comes after the fact, but nonetheless, It really does summarize the entire political zeitgeist that was to finally appear over those horrible 4 years.
Well, and I think it mirrors the night itself of watching that happen in utter shock that was almost laughable but undergirded with this despair.
This utter despair
at the whole fabric of what you believe being ripped apart, you know, and having that all sort of crystallized in the popping of a champagne cork and the idea of holding on to it for 4 years. I mean, you know, it's lasted much longer and it was on its way for much longer, as you said, but I love the way this poem just says it so simply in that one image.
Yeah, and that's one of the strengths of this poem, because that image is accessible, but it's so packed with, it resonates, it's evocative. And
right.
You know, it's for people who like to read poetry, you never read a poem just once. You have to read it. I mean, in order to really appreciate it, you have to read it more than once because it reveals more of itself. The more you get into it, the more you learn about what the poet is saying, and the greater its emotional impact. That's what I'm trying to say. And I think that the best poems are the ones that make you want to reread them. And that one, November 2016 by Janet Fitch, was one of those poems. So I'm going to ask you once again, if you could pick a poem from this, from Chapter 2, Political Promiscuity.
Let's see. I'm torn between, well, I'm, you know, letting the book open. It opened on Blink and Dust Settled. Which would you prefer, Richard?
Let's hear Blink.
This is from David Orr, who designed this beautiful book. Blink. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your mind. Suddenly cease making sense to yourself. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your truth and renew your search from scratch. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your way, no path to keep to and thoughtlessly follow. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your looks, traumas on your face everyone can read. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your sight. Would all be black? Or shadows you'd chase? In the blink of an eye, you could lose your worry, live in the now, and stop sweating the consequences. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your bearings, spinning without a true north to still you. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your smile, concern riding rampant over the planes of your face. In the blink of an eye, you could lose your time, second hand, sweeping ashes aside.
Wow, that's another really, really sharply observed. I mean, David Orr knows what to leave in, what to leave out, and when to end it, which is really a skill that only poets who are intimately connected with their art can do that with ease. And I don't know, I mean,
very
I'm assuming...
very precise.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted to say. He's very precise. And, again, it's, you know, the what sets poetry apart from prose is that you have to put so much information into a short piece. Or even if you were to write an epic poem, nonetheless, it's a novel is like 3-4 times longer than even the longest epic poem. And the talent of a poet is to select the right words that are charged with meaning and that really resonate.
Right.
And I think that's something that we see in Blink, something that is right there in that poem.
And this is actually a rather long poem for David because he is really adept at doing that. And I think it's because he is, you know, he's a designer, filmmaker. During our first year together, he had his first show at the Tibet House in New York, which is the Gallery of the Dalai Lama. And he had a whole series of artworks, but one in particular that makes me think of his work are skulls. But unlike a normal skull where they're not at perfect symmetry, he makes these in perfect symmetry. And it's just very interesting. There's something very otherworldly about them. You should have a look, Richard. I think
the way you describe it, I was going to say that the way you describe it, it's like the Platonic idea of the skull, which is in Plato, the idea is perfect. And the physical embodiment is imperfect.
Right. Exactly. And his other specialty in this particular exhibit is making mandalas of slivers of the moon. So with repetitions of photographs of the moon, he made 52 mandalas. And this was a project, you know, a gift to the community on a weekly basis during the pandemic. So within this group, there were so many people giving gifts to the community to keep us floating and hopeful when it really felt like,
yeah.
You know, it was almost like, pinch me. I still have, there's still blood coming to the surface, you know.
Yeah.
It was magical. Yeah.
And chapter 3 is things that don't bump in the night, circles and cycles. And one of the poems that I liked in this section a lot is Brendan's poem, If It's Dark Enough. It's Brendan Constantine, listeners. So if you could lay that one on us, Peggy.
Let's see. Where is that poem?
Page 49.
Yeah, Brendan only came to this once. But, you know, as my longtime teacher, he has special privileges. So this I fell in love with this poem. And it actually... Well, let me read it first, and then I'll remember which one it is. He has two poems in the book, If It's Dark Enough. I didn't know there was light inside red brick. I thought it was rain or that a little sun rubbed off as the day passed, but I was wrong. Every stone is marbled with flame. To see it, you first have to hurt. Though disappointment will work fine if it's dark enough. It also helps to get drunk, and if possible, lie down at the base of a wall, your head resting on an arm, and look up. It's like the bricks make a cobbled road, isn't it? A road into night. Tell me it doesn't glow. Tell me it needs any help to shine.
And, of course, that is a quintessential Brendan Constantine.
Mm-hmm. This is actually the one who did write in our class, in our one meditation that he joined us. There's another one in here, which I'll just point to because the title of it is, what do you call that when it's the letters mixed up but the same letters?
Anagram.
It's an anagram of slow lightning.
Yeah.
It's titled Long Whistling. And this one he wrote in response to the metaphor dice. And for a short time, Taylor Molly joined us in the morning, and we played with metaphor dice. And so this one came from that. Anyway, I just wanted to point to it because it's so lovely to have an anagram of the title in the book. Very special
yeah.
to us. We had a contest, and whoever could figure it out got a free book, and it got figured out by Lucien Zell, a poet from Prague, who's also in the book.
So let's hear one of your choice from Things That Don't Bump in the Night, Chapter 3.
Things That Don't Bump in the Night. Well, I'm a big fan of, I'm stuck between two. Well, I'm going to do something just to shout out to E.J. Bunachova, who was the owner of Silver Park Arts, which, of course, lost its fresh footing during the pandemic and no longer exists, and she moved back to Vermont. So this is a poem that, you know, she wrote in Vermont. It's a poem of place called Birch Point Road. Old Percy on Birch Point Road was everyone's favorite apple man. his barn a place of gathering and sweet anticipation of hard work, rest, plus dirt and rot and fermentation. The life of an apple is never done, with good sharp cider waiting at the end. Of daily battles fought long and hard won, this fickle fine tree from blossom to shade to food for hungry caterpillars, across to bear for cursing farmers tearing down the web, while crushing prickly, oozing, sticky, bruising, seizing, tearing, filthing, ruining, nasty little eating machines under the sole of a long-lived, well-weathered work boot worn by father and son and uncle all in turn. This is what it means to care for something. This is what it means to bring as one community and family, to take the filth and slime and rotten bad intentions and hoe them in with honest excrement from everybody's favorite cow. Well, she's got no agenda but to warm a barn and recycle grass in blissful rumination. And from the fertile ground of buried woes bursts forth an apple-bearing tree with red and green and sweet, tangy, bitter, bright thoughts of summer and fall and harvests yet to come, of springs just past the sleeping season, little drops of crispy happiness that you can take back home to share right now with all, by the pallet or the bushel.
And this is a wonderful poem because it's, we do need these kind of poems that raise our spirits. And this does
right.
that. I mean, it's not at all, it's not at remotely sentimental. It's all, it's about places as you introduced it. It's a vivid particular. It is something that could happen in the real world and probably did happen in the real world.
Well, it did.
And,
right.
It has this sense of the whole poem is about renewal, which is something that we really need. And, you know, it's not all horror and nightmare. There is possibility. There are seeds beneath the snow of dread. And you know, this is one of them. And that's why I like this poem a lot. I'm glad that it made
this
it in
the,
there.
This is the point of that final chapter, really, is to, you know, So thank you. Yeah, she's a pretty amazing writer, EJ. And, you know, a visionary that also has two wonderful children and just couldn't make a go there, you know, with the pandemic. But boy, what a spirit she has. And Vermont is lucky to have her. She's a novelist that has a book called, a memoirist, has a book, I think it's called Fresh Cut, about working in the flower industry. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to close our discussion with the epilogue, which is really interesting, Akara Ukara Nikara Iti, by yourself. So lay that one on us, if you would.
So, well, I learned about this phrase from the Shanti Shanti sisters, who are these two crazy girls from Reno, Nevada, who grew up in India and just fell in love with chanting and what they call the Sanskrit buzz. And they actually translate Sanskrit, which, you know, I explored for many, many years. They're wonderful. They're wonderful singers. So they discovered, they couldn't figure out what this meant, Akara, Ukara, Makara. And Kara means power. And so it's A-U-M. It's the power of Om, but not just the universal power, but all of its individual parts. So that's what it means. Akara, Akara, Makara, Iti. You don't have to know anything to begin to do nothing. silence is its own master, carries its own surplus. No tonnage, storage, or drayage involved. Just like riding the imagination on a carpet of corrupted intervals, a difference in pitch to a chord. The music of the spheres is mouth quiet to naught. Beat held in crescendo realized, passionate soprano to Gregorian chant, or is it louder than a sun flare through space hits earth? When there is nowhere to escape, don't just flail, be still.
And a wonderful epilogue and a wonderful ending to this anthology. And what I really liked about it is not only is it about music, the poem itself has that melopoeia, that music, storage, drayage, tonnage, consonants following consonants. I really like that. I think that came off perfectly, I think, for this poem. Well, we are out of time, listeners. We've been talking to Peggy Dobrir, poet and editor of this fine anthology, which you can order directly from Peggy's website. I do hope that that's where you decide to order first, but also you can order it from, what was the bookstore, Peggy?
The Book Jewel in Westchester, and you can either walk
in
or order online from them as well.
And they do fill out mail orders, so we know we have people listening from all over the world. So go to Peggy's website, go to the Book Jewel, and as a last resort, if you can't help it, go to Amazon. But do get this fine anthology. It's really worth having. All of the poems in it are fresh, new, and interesting. And Peggy, you did a terrific job of putting this all together.
Oh, Richard, thank you so much, and Raphael for setting this up. I really enjoyed speaking with you both.
All right. We've been talking to Peggy Dobrir, listeners, and again, thank you for your time, Peggy.
All right. You're welcome, and thanks again.
You're welcome. Now we begin our second portion of the show with our second guest, which will be Gabriella J. Sufa, who does Iron Man runs. Did I say that right, or did I just mess it up?
No, Gabrielle, but you can just call me Gabby. It's fine.
Gabby works easier for me. Thank you. You just completed another Iron Man, right? And I believe you mentioned when I read on Facebook that you had a better time.
Yes, thankfully. I improved my time a lot from last year.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, you do the running, the bicycling, and where was the time more better for you, the running, the bicycling, or the swimming, or all of them?
So, I would say the swimming and the running, I was able to see the most improvement. The swim last year, I did a 55-minute for the 2.4. mile swim. It's downriver, so you got a little current kind of helping you. But it's the same course, so it's kind of cool to compare times from last year. I was able to shave 7 minutes off and swim a 48 this year, so I was super happy about that. I was kind of not expecting that, so that was a good surprise. The bike, I did not shave any time at all whatsoever, and it was partly, I think, because of the weather conditions. It was very rainy and kind of stormy and gusty most of the bike. And I also dropped my nutrition going over some train tracks. So I stopped and went and got it. And so that kind of cost me some time too. But it ended up being like almost the exact same bike time as last year, which is kind of funny. But the run, that was like the biggest improvement, I think, was the marathon. So last year I did a 3:38 marathon off the bike. And this year I ended up doing a 3:23 and had the fastest run of the day for the women and 14th fastest run for the men. I was super excited about that.
Well,
I think part
time.
Of it too was thanks. I think part of it too was I was kind of bummed about the bike that I couldn't really push it because it was kind of dangerous, and so I was very cautious and just so by the time I got to the run, like I just wanted to push it and just I kind of took a risk running the pace I did because I wasn't really expecting to run that aggressive of a pace, but I was just kind of frustrated with the bike. So,
I can understand that.
Yeah.
No, well, it's like yesterday I had a 15 mile side ache when I did the Long Beach Marathon, so that was fun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because you don't want to stop, because if you stop, you're really going to feel the pain. So at the same time, you're going, but you're in pain.
Yeah.
And it wasn't fun. But, yeah, I can understand the whole bicycle thing and the nutrition thing because it's kind of you need the nutrition, but at the same time, when you go back for it, you're going to lose time.
Yeah, definitely. But I'm glad I got it, though, because it was so early in the race. To be without it, it would have destroyed my whole race.
No, I could understand that. I mean, I don't know why I do it, but when I do marathons, I don't need that much liquid. I'll drink liquid once in a while, but I don't usually drink liquid during the marathons for some reason, which my friends think I'm nuts, but I do drink a lot of water afterwards. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of water afterwards. But what's the difference between training for an Ironman and, say, a marathon? What do you find the differences are? And what do you need to do more to brace yourself for the endurance?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a little trickier training for triathlon because you have to balance all three sports. So sometimes it's kind of tricky because you don't want one workout to affect the other one or not be able to do it as well. So you kind of have to balance the training to be able to benefit from the workout. And running off the bike, that's a big one, a big difference. And it's a very odd feeling when you're not used to it. so that's definitely one of the biggest differences, I think, is being able to run off the bike. So doing bricks where you bike and then you run after, just to kind of train your legs to be able to respond after biking. So that's kind of unique to triathlon and multi-sport races. And
it seems really intense to have to train. I mean, the way you can end up training is you're training three different things, swimming, the bike and the running, so it's like, and how do you allot the time to train for all three different things?
Yeah, it's definitely challenging, but I just try to balance. Like, I can't, I don't do all three every day. Like, I'll kind of, like, tomorrow, for example, I have a run workout and a bike workout. But I don't have a swim workout. I did a swim today and some strength training. So it's kind of like fitting it in the pieces and balance. But I have to be very disciplined with my time management. So I have to plan, like, my days ahead of time around my work and trying to fit the workouts in and getting up early, going to bed early. So it takes a lot of discipline, I guess, and planning.
I just training for the marathon for me is a lot. Like, I just couldn't imagine having three different activities that you're going to do. I think I'd get a little overwhelmed, and I'd adapt, but it'd be a lot to adapt to for me. So I mean, the whole triathlon thing impresses me because it just, it's a lot, it takes, I mean, it's something that seems to me would take a lot of toll on your body just doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with triathlon training, I feel like it's a little bit more well-rounded. When I was a pure runner and I would run every day, I kind of got injured a little easier. But with triathlon, I don't have to run every day. I'll run maybe like 3 or 4 days a week, and I'm doing other sports, so I feel like it's less pounding on my body from the running, and then I still get some kind of strength on the bike, and then get to give my legs a break when I do my swim workout. So it's kind of balanced, which is nice. I like that about triathlon type training.
I have yet to achieve balance between lifting weights and running because sometimes I don't know exactly when to taper off from the leg training with the weight because if I don't taper off too soon, my legs are heavier when I run the marathons and that really does hurt.
Usually I try not to touch, like at least a whole week before a race. I won't do any weights at all. So like I'll give it a week to 10 days of not doing a lot of strength training before an event, especially legs, because you want to try to be as fresh as you can.
Oh, yeah, I definitely believe in that. But the thing I did notice about training my legs with weights, which I never did because someone gave me misinformation years ago about it would be bad for running. I read somewhere that, you know, squats and certain things are good for the training. My running's become easier. But if you get, it's like you said, if you get closer to the run, you got to taper off and just leave the weights alone for at least a week. Sometimes I think a week and a half just to be safe.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's great for training. You just, you know, when it comes time to prepare to race, like, then that's the time to back off. But, yeah, I mean, strength training's great. It helps with your running efficiency. It helps prevent injury, helps get you stronger. It even helps, like, with your bone mass, too, as you get older. That's important. I try to do some strength training pretty regular. But I like to try to do, when I'm doing my lower body, I like to kind of time it so that it's the same day as when I do a hard run workout. So I'll do the hard run workout first, and then I'll do lower body leg strength like a little later in the day. That way it kind of, like, I want to be able to focus on that run workout without having heavy legs if I did, like, leg day before or the day before, you know?
No, I definitely understand. But, you know, the funny thing I've learned from my strength training for my legs is I can't do speed runs when I do a heavy leg workout, but I can do a distance run no problem when I've done a heavy leg workout, I think, because there's more intensity in the speed run than, say, the distance run because you can go slower because you're not trying to be fast.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, I just realized that because I was actually doing I was doing the speed run after the leg workout, which turned out to be a bad idea.
Ooh, yeah. That's all painful.
No, it was, and then that's when I switched it up. I'm like, maybe this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
What do you prefer from, why do you prefer, I mean, I don't know if you prefer it, but why do you prefer Ironmans to the triathlon to, say, the marathon? Why do you find it better?
Well, honestly, I haven't really raced a standalone marathon yet. I would love to.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, the only marathons so far I've raced have been an Ironman.
Wow. But I think, I don't know. I definitely respect doing the triathlon thing, and I wish I could because I couldn't swim to save my life. I mean, good. I mean, I can swim to swim, but not to the point where it's like 55 minutes. I mean, I'd probably sink in about 10.
But no, I mean, I really respect the sport, and you know, I mean, it's just the endurance that it takes to do a triathlon is, like, it's impressive to me. I mean, when I've seen bicycle people trailing, when I'm running up a hill and they're riding up the hill, I'm like, that's got to hurt more than me running up the hill. I mean,
yeah,
I know they have an easy time coming down the hill, but going up the hill, like, I just feel it. I feel their legs hurting. I could just imagine how much intensity you have to do just to be able to get up that hill.
Oh yeah.
And
definitely.
I run up steep hills. So when I see them doing it, and I go to the guy, so he's doing it once. He goes, no, I'm doing it five times. I go, dude, I'm just running up this hill once. And I just looked at him like, dude, you're nuts. Five times, that's going to kill your legs.
No, oh, wow.
I mean, I ran up. He passed me twice, and I'm like, that's it. I'm running down the hill now.
Dang.
But no, I mean, I'm impressed by – I've always been impressed watching people on bicycles running up hills.
I've done both. And I feel like I've ran uphills and biked uphills, and I feel like biking is a little harder.
No, I think it is. I just think because it's just like you're on a bike, and I think it takes more strength to pedal than to run. I can just feel it because I can imagine it because I've never ridden up a hill. I probably never will, but. I do know I hate them when I'm running down the hill and they're just zooming past me, and I think that's a revenge. I think that's a revenge when I pass them running, but they'll just pass me when I'm going down the hill. But yeah,
true.
I mean, I really have a lot of respect for that, for the triathlons, and like the more I run, I tend to, like, you know, when I meet more runners and the more I learn about it, I get more interested, and I wish I could swim because I would love to do a triathlon. You know, and bike more and all that stuff, because it just seems a different level.
Yeah. Well, I feel like duathlons are pretty good to start. Like, if you're not super comfortable swimming, duathlons are kind of like a gateway into triathlon from a runner. So it's just you run, bike, run. So extra running instead of swimming.
I think I've paid attention to a lot of things where I've seen, you know, how much, you know, I mean, I think it takes a lot of strength to be able to swim that long and to be able to, you know, do all that. And it's just, to me, it's kind of really amazing that, you know, that a body can take that. I mean, I learned a lot, you know, I've learned a lot just every day running and realizing how much my body can actually take. You know,
yeah.
I mean, everything's a lesson, and it's just like, I mean, I see your post when you're having a good day and you do a bad day, so I know you take all of this, you take your training seriously, and you're very committed to it. I mean, and it's a lot, you know, when you're putting that much of yourself into it.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
definitely.
I mean,
you gotta take the good days and the not so good days.
No, it's always nice to hear when somebody you've talked to before is actually, their time's improving, and, you know, they're getting better at it, you know, and that's always a plus when you talk to people and you realize that, you know, they're gaining, they're not going backwards, and they're not, you know, they're not stopping, you know. And it's like, I mean, yesterday during the run, the freaking fire, I mean, I was on the 20th mile, and somebody was down, and the firemen were taking him away, and it's like, damn. You know, they had to come get him because he couldn't even get up. And it's like, I don't know if he was a runner who'd run before or a runner who was his first run, or, you know, I mean, my thing is hoping it's just a first timer, because if you're a runner who's been doing it for a while and you're crashing on the 20th mile, there's something that went wrong.
Yeah. That's scary.
Because the thing I noticed, what I love about runners is when you're running, if you stop for a minute and you're, like, you know, tired, someone will pat you on the back to, you know, egg you on. And I like I love the camaraderie of the community. You know, and I know it's unselfish, and they want you to finish as much as they're going to finish.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a thing on the run, too.
No, I think in our sport, even triathlons and marathons, the community tends to be really supportive because you're competing against yourself, but it's not. It takes a second just to pat somebody to keep going,
where I know other sports is more, you know, more about people just finishing and getting what they need for themselves. You know,
yeah.
That's what I really like about the running community. I mean, once in a while, you know, I send you messages and you encourage me and I encourage you because I'm happy that you're doing well. You know, I'm happy that, you know, that you're, you know, that you're getting where you want to be. And when I hear, the thing to me is that when I hear that a runner is actually getting to travel out of the country, and that makes me happy because, I mean, there's one thing about running and triathlons, you see a lot of the scenery that you don't see when you're just walking it or when you're driving, because when you're running, you can actually take a look and see things that you wouldn't notice when you're, like, just on the way somewhere. And even though you're focused on the run, you actually could take the time to actually pay attention to what's around you.
True.
You know, and that's what I like about it.
Yeah, it's like you get to explore, you know? Like you get to explore where you're traveling to and instead of, like, just driving by. So I feel like you're able to experience more when you run or do a race or something, you know, when you travel somewhere.
Yeah, I feel the same way about it. And how do you do your choices? I've just started trying really hard to eat healthy. I've actually started drinking kale drinks and like kale salads, and it's like I feel better.
Oh wow!
But it's just taken me a while to get into the habit because I actually realized, hey, you know, this stuff can actually taste good if you mix them the right way.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of days ago I had something with kale, ginger, apple. And it tasted good, you know, and it worked. But it's like, how do you manage your nutrition? Because I just to keep the level of what you need, what do you consider a good nutritious meal, like, to keep yourself functioning?
So I use the MyFitnessPal app a lot, and I have it connected with my Garmin. So whenever I train and do workouts and stuff, the calories that I burn get synced to my MyFitnessPal, so then it kind of gives me a goal of how many calories a day I try to shoot for, and protein and carbs and fats. So I just try to match what I'm burning to make sure I'm eating enough. But I'll usually do a lot of, like, for dinner today, for example, I made some quinoa and brown rice mixed together. I made some curry lentils and chicken breast. So I made like a big bowl of that. So it was pretty good. But yeah, I do a lot of whole grains, lean proteins, veggies, fruit. I do some dairy too. Usually, like cheese. I'm a little sensitive to milk. But I can do like cheese and yogurt, so I stick to that. And some dried fruit, like for energy. And in the morning, I take this drink every morning. It's like beet powder. So I'll do beet powder with like an emergency packet, like the vitamin packet thing. And BCAAs, like aminos, and I mix it all up, and it's like a little energy pre-workout drink.
But that sounds interesting.
It's like
usually do,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Because I usually do a ginger shot. Now. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's almost better than coffee.
Well, yeah. I mean, I love coffee, but I've stopped drinking coffee for almost a year now, but I miss it. But I have a ginger shot with cayenne pepper and lemon juice in the morning.
Oh, wow.
So, nice. I mean, that
I
helps too. But I like the beet juice idea with energy because I never thought about mixing energy with anything. So you just told me.
Yeah.
It could be interesting. So you take like a beet powder and mix it together with the energy.
Yeah. Yeah, beet powder is so good. I mean, beets are so good for you. They keep on coming up with more benefits. It's just, I love them.
Yeah, no, I think There's a lot of things I want to stick in my protein drink. Right now I'm thinking turmeric, I'm thinking beet powder and some kale. And
mm-hmm.
I just like having all that stuff mixed in and then just drink it down and, you know, and then you feel healthy. And then, you know, my work is kind of bad because they keep giving me free lasagnas. That's kind of hard because my metabolism's so screwed up that I'm always hungry. So, like, someone offers me free food, I'm like, crap. Or usually, it's a $45 lasagna. I can't say no.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the same way. I feel like as long as the majority of your diet is healthy, like as long as you're getting in the good nutrients, like it's okay to splurge and have stuff. Especially with the amount, like when you're training a lot and you're always famished, you know, because you're just burning so much.
Yep.
So just make sure you're giving it what it needs first, and then yeah.
Yeah, the way you train, I think you'd be probably more famished than I am, and it's amazing that you mentioned that. What you eat seems like you have a real good control of your diet, because God knows I have none. You know exactly what to put in your system.
I did also have some pumpkin bread today. I made pumpkin bread, so there's that. I mean, I do have a sweet tooth, so I'll have some treats once in a while. But, I mean, the majority of my diet is pretty clean.
No, it seems I try really hard.
Like just getting in the anti-inflammatory foods helps a lot too. Like I'll almost every day I'll have this shake that has tart cherry juice and blueberries and protein powder and PB Fit powder, and I have that like almost every day. But like the blueberries and the tart cherry juice is supposed to be really good for inflammation and help with recovery. I'll have that like right after a hard workout or something.
Huh. I actually just looked it up on Amazon, tart cherry juice.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, you can find it.
I actually walk and go get it now. Yeah, no, I just saw it for a certain amount of Whole Foods, because, I mean, I'm always interested in things that, you know, like, that, you know, I can benefit from some. I mean, when it comes to health right now, I'll try anything, and it's... But the funny thing that bugs me about people and their protein powders and their stuff like that is when they complain that it tastes bad, I don't care about the taste. I care about the benefits or what I'm getting. So, I mean, if it tastes bad, I don't care as long as it's helping me be healthy. I mean, because when you put turmeric and mix it in a protein drink, it is going to taste bad. You know, no matter what you do, it's just going to taste bad. I mean, you can try hard to get rid of turmeric paste, but you're not going to.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like... So I never understood when people complain about pre-workouts. Well, it tastes bad. I go, does it help you lift and run?
Right.
And they'll go, yeah. So then why do you care about the taste? And that's what everybody always complains about in their reads. Well, it tastes awful. I'm like, but does it work? That's all I care about. I don't care that it tastes bad. I don't have time to worry about the taste. I'm more interested in results.
Yeah.
You know.
Like the benefits outweigh the taste.
No, I definitely think that, because...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like... So,
and there's
tart cherry juice
that you can make. Yeah, and it actually tastes really good. Like, if you can get, like a vanilla protein or cookies and cream, that's what I've been using a lot. Cookies and cream flavored
vanilla.
Protein. Or vanilla, like a cherry vanilla. Yeah. It goes really well with vanilla.
So you can mix the tart cherry juice with the vanilla?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll put it in with the vanilla protein powder with the blueberries.
So far I got blueberries. I got blueberries right now, so that works. I mean, it's just I like having different options of things. So.
I forgot almond butter, too. I put that in it, too.
Really?
I almost forgot. Yeah, I put
really?
Some almond butter in there.
So, you know, peanut butter, but almond butter.
Mm-hmm. Almond butter. I feel like the almond butter goes better with the vanilla and the tart cherry. Like, it just kind of blends better, the taste.
I know.
It actually tastes pretty good.
Actually, I think I'm going to try that. I'm actually going to, it's my day off, and I tend not to like walk, but I think I'm actually going to walk and go get some of that stuff.
Nice.
You know, I don't like waiting. I don't like waiting to try things. I'm kind of impatient when it comes to things. You know, it's like.
Well,
no,
you know how you like it.
Probably. Well, so when's your next triathlon, and are you training for anything right now, or are you just training to train?
Actually, I do have another one coming up. So I took my 2-week recovery after Chattanooga, and now I'm back to
mm-hmm.
Ironman training again, getting ready for Ironman Arizona in November. And that one's actually going to be my first race as a pro, like a pro race with an actual pro field.
Oh, cool.
I'm super excited and nervous about it, but. It'll be exciting.
What's the difference between the ones you've done in the pro field?
So the one that I did at Chattanooga, it was an age group race. So I just
mm-hmm.
got my pro card this summer, so I could race as a professional. So I'm not eligible for age group awards anymore. So I would only be eligible to place in the pro field. But you can only race in the pro field if you're a pro.
Is that better for you now, or is it gonna keep you from other races you might want? Or
yeah.
So you like the idea of being a pro racer instead of just doing races right now? So it's a move up for you.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like it'll push me more, for sure.
Great. I mean, yeah, it's a good thing you're doing it in November, because I've been in Arizona during the summer, and it's not a good place to be.
Oh, no. Thanks.
No,
yeah, I hear it gets really, really hot.
No, I made a mistake
even
going
November.
Barefooted out during the summer. It burned my foot. That was a bad
Ooh.
Idea.
Ow, yeah. I hear, like, the weather can be a little unpredictable, too. Like, someone told me that November, it could either be, like, cold or hot. Like, you just kind of never know.
Yeah, I know. It seems like you're definitely, you know, moving forward, and, you know, your time's improving, and that's great. It's like, I was happy that I shaved 9 minutes off my marathon yesterday, and then mad because I had a side ache, and I might have been able to save more time off.
Yeah.
So I kept looking
minutes.
For other people
Absolutely.
To blame other than myself. I just kept looking for other people to blame. It's like, well, the hotel I slept in was uncomfortable. Let's see. Can't blame those on you because I haven't had that for 3 days. Ah, crap. It's fine. It's just my body not working. But yeah, I know. But
yeah.
I think you're the same about the – I think – just doing the running and these races, I don't know. I think that runners and people that you do, we just enjoy it for some reason. And I don't know. I just need to keep doing it. Because even when I'm in pain doing the race, I'm like, fuck, I don't want to do this again. Then when I finish, when's the next one?
Yep. Exactly. It's addicting. The sport.
No, it's kind of no, because when you're going through it, when I was in the pain in the side neck, my head, my legs, my side's going, no, you're not doing this again. And then when I finish, I'm like, that wasn't too bad. I'm not dead.
Yeah.
I'm not the guy in the 20th mile going home in an ambulance.
Yeah.
I'm good.
That's just in that moment, like, got through it.
Yeah.
And your feelings change throughout the race too. Like
because the funny thing is, I felt the bulldog that took me 8 hours seemed to be easier, even though my legs froze up. I think I felt more pain on the marathon from the side than I did when my legs froze up during the bulldog.
Oh wow!
Which is it's kind of feeling because I think because my legs froze. And I couldn't walk for like 10 minutes, but it went away. But the side ache was constant for 15 miles.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like, you know, it kind of felt like a little alien was going to come out of my stomach, and I wasn't happy about it.
Yikes. Yeah, I got to figure out what caused that.
I don't know. I have no idea, but I'm definitely gonna, you know, try to watch, figure out what I'm doing in the train that might have triggered it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, all you can do is just keep going on and try to figure it out as you go on. I'm pretty
True.
Sure when you do your triathlon and you don't come up with the right time, you try to figure a way to fix that and keep going.
Definitely.
I think that's all you can do.
Definitely. You gotta learn from it. Like I am actually during the marathon part, I got really bad blisters. And I couldn't figure out like how to fix that. And after the race, like I realized like I need to do something about this. And I ripped out the inserts that were in the shoe and I put like new inserts in it, and that actually fixed it. But you just gotta like learn from it. Find ways to fix it.
I think you can. No, I think the inserts help, and some shoes need them and some don't. And it's just, you know, sometimes I think when you put inserts, that kind of hurts too and helps your running because it makes the shoe weigh more and it doesn't always help. But,
true.
And every shoe is different. I mean, right now I want to try a new shoe just for trail running, and it's like, because I got the Big Bear Marathon coming up, and that's going to be in high revelation and in the trail, and it's like, oh, man, what am I doing to myself?
Oh, wow.
But, you know, the thing is, I think with us is, you know, the things that we do, we're just going to keep doing it because it is addictive, and, you know, some people look at it, you're fucking crazy, but I don't know. For me, it relaxes me. I felt really relaxed even though I was in pain when I was running. Which kind of makes no sense, but, you know, when you get towards the end, you're like, thank God. Especially when you got a side ache.
Yeah.
Like, thank freaking God. But it's been great talking to you. And I'm hope, good luck on the going pro. I mean, that's something definitely exciting for you. And, you know, I don't know. That's a new level for you. And I'm pretty sure you do well at it because, I mean, I keep up with the things that you say on Facebook and about your running and your training, so I know you're always trying to get better.
Thanks. Yeah, always trying. It's exciting. I'm just super thankful for this new opportunity.
And we've been talking to, I don't want to mispronounce your name. You like Gabby.
Gabby
J. I don't want to pronounce your last name. Sufer?
Yeah, Sufer.
Wow,
yeah.
I got that right. Just couldn't get the first name right. But it's been great talking to her, and thank you for coming on the show, and I'd love to talk to you after you do Arizona and see how you did there.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking.
Mom. No, it's great having you on because, I mean, when I talk to you, I learn things that I didn't know, and it's always great to be able to talk to someone who can actually give you a little bit of knowledge at the same time as you talk to them, and thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
It's been great having you. That's been another episode, another show of The Poet Runner, and thank you for listening. And the next show will probably be Friday with Billy Burgos. We'll be talking to him about his writing and another runner. And thank you for listening. This has been the Poet Runner Show. Thank you. Thanks again.